welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working from home on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, February 25th, 2021. Chiefs from Central Equatoria State accuse internal displaced persons from Jonglei of land grabbing.
These people, we had accepted them because of the floods, and we told them these places are for people. You stay here, but when the floods reduces, then you will return to your place. Now they have refused.
And some internal displaced persons in Darfur need urgent help.
People are reported to actually be sleeping outside under the trees because they cannot fit anymore, and there is not enough tents for them to sleep in the inside.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Traditional chiefs from Central Equatorial State are accusing some members of the Bor community of illegally occupying lands and grazing cattle on farmlands in the villages of Mogiri, Bilinyang, Kabu, Kubi, Timan, and Gumbo. A press secretary in the office of the governor of Central Equatorial State says the governor will form a committee to investigate the land grabs. For VOA News, Winnie Chirino reports from Magui in Eastern Equatorial State.
Marino Marcelino, head chief of Tokiman Aircourt, says some people displaced by floods from Jonglei State's Bor County have grabbed land in his area and are competing with the real owners by selling the land with fake documents to enrich themselves.
On your way to Jebel, those are all people from Bor. They are the ones grabbing the land. You go to Gumbo Market, it is all grabbed. The market that was well demarcated and its land documents distributed has all been grabbed. It is now all white iron sheets. I have my own land there. I made a foundation, but when I went to check, I found it was grabbed. I told them it is my place. They told me this is South Sudan, and it is their place.
Marcelino says the IDPs have grabbed land in Mogiri, Bilinyang, Kabu, Kubiritiman, Gumbo, and other villages. He says chiefs in the area allowed IDPs from Bor who fled their homes due to the flooding to temporary camp in the area. He says he and other local chiefs are surprised to find that the IDPs refused to return home after the flooding has ended.
These people, we had accepted them because of the floods, and we told them these places are for people. You stay here, but when the floods reduces, then you will return to your place. Now they have refused this and have instead grabbed and have sold the lands out. This land grabbing is up to Budugwe, my village.
Marcelina says some of the people who have grabbed land set themselves in the marketplaces holding a gun, a tape measure, and some fake land documents and stamps. He also complains that some of the IDPs are destroying crops by grazing their cattle in farms belonging to residents of the host community. Government spokesperson Michael Makwe, who is also chairperson of the Bor community in Juba, says the farmers and cattle keepers can live together so long as they mutually agree on how to peacefully resolve a dispute between themselves.
The president had ever been clear. He had been saying that the cattle and the farms can coexist because they're, even if you go to Bargazar, wherever you go, where cattle keepers are, they cultivate. And they don't destroy crops. And nobody complains about destruction of crops. That is one. Number two, if I have a farm and your cattle enter my farm and they destroy it, you open a case and you are compensated for your destroyed crops. This is something known to the cattle owners and to the farmers all over.
Derek Derrickson, press secretary in Central Equatoria State Governor Emmanuel Adil Anthony's office, says the governor has yet to receive any official complaint from the chiefs, but he says the governor saw an open letter addressed to him circulating on social media. Derrickson says the governor is aware of land grabs and intends to form a committee to investigate the issue.
One, the state government structures are in place, they are officially installed, the governor will now see the line ministry responsible, and this line ministry with the work or with the help or assistance of the security operatives, they will be now in order to see how best this directive of the governor can be effected up to the grassroots level. And there's a committee which is yet to be formed. It's going to be headed by the line Minister of Physical Infrastructure to holistically deal with all these land-related issues within the estate.
Derrickson says early this year, when tensions rose between farmers and cattle keepers in Juba, the governor formed a committee to hold talks between the two groups so they could peacefully address their conflicts.
One of the resolutions that reached the office was for the immediate evacuation or immediate removal of these cattle keepers from the places that they have occupied temporarily to their places of origin. And they were given a duration or a time frame of 1 week, which I think is not all that happening speedily.
In an open letter to Governor Emmanuel Adil Anthony circulating on social media platforms like Facebook and WhatsApp, the chiefs are calling for immediate relocation of the IDPs to their areas of origin. The chiefs are also calling for the immediate transfer and replacement of the security personnel in Rajaf Payam, claiming the officers have overstayed and are no more helpful and are allied to the IDPs. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sirino, reporting from Magui.
The International Displacement Monitoring Center says 184,000 people displaced by armed violence in Darfur are in their need of food, shelter, and sanitation. The group says Sudan's transitional government should work with humanitarian partners to provide relief to affected families in Darfur, implement provisions of the October 2020 peace agreement, and resettle IDPs back to their homes. For VOA News, Nabil Biagio has more from Washington.
The IDMC says in a span of 3 days from January 15 to January 18, 183,000 people were displaced in Darfur by intercommunal violence. That's more than the number of displacements in the whole of 2019 as well as 2020. Most of the new displacements took place in El Jenena town of West Darfur State when violence broke out between armed militiamen and members of the Masalit tribe. Displacements was also recorded in El Greda in East Jebel Marra in South Darfur and Tawila in North Darfur. Ivana Hajmanova, the IDMC's regional coordinator for Sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, and North Africa, says those people fled to displacement sites or gathering places which are already overcrowded.
People are reported to actually be sleeping outside under the trees because they cannot fit anymore, and there is not enough tents for them to sleep in the, inside. At the same time, we also saw that there was a large-scale destruction when it comes to destroying crops, killing livestock, and so on. So those people also immediately lost their source of livelihoods. So it would be much more difficult for them to then return and reestablish their lives after they are able to return home.
Hajmanova says the same time, 80 to 87% of their crops have been destroyed, leading to food insecurity. Around 60% of those displaced are under 18, according to IDMC. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says tens of thousands of people displaced in and around El Jenena are temporarily using public buildings, including 32 schools, which has disrupted learning for 58,000 school children. Many others who could not make it to IDP camps are sheltering in eastern Jebel Marra and living under trees with no food, drinking water, sanitation or hygiene, according to IDMC. Adam Rijal is the spokesperson for IDPs in Darfur. He told South Sudan in Focus from Nyerteta town in central Darfur state, the conditions are very hard for IDPs in the area. Speaking in Arabic, he says, the humanitarian situation is very harsh and getting worse for IDPs because there is not enough humanitarian assistance. He says food has arrived, but not all IDPs have received it due to the huge number of displaced people. The humanitarian situation with IDPs is very harsh and ever deteriorating because life-saving humanitarian assistance remains lacking. Some food assistance has arrived, but it has not reached all the IDPs because their number is large, more than 184,000. Assistance is coming mainly from the World Food Program, but it's very little because people have lost everything, clothing, food, drinking water, and all the necessary needs, he told South Sudan in Focus. Hajmanova says many of the IDPs in Darfur have been displaced multiple times by conflict and do not feel safe. She says many would like to return to their homes, but the government must first provide security and let IDPs decide if they want to return to their homes or reintegrate with host communities where they're staying.
The peace agreement has provisions on IDP return and on kind of helping find IDPs a solution to their displacement. I think that's a very important good and very good step when it comes to resolving the crisis in Darfur. So I think it's now really it's up to the government and also the support of the humanitarian development agencies to actually take these commitments from the peace agreement and realize them. And help IDPs find those lasting solutions.
She says the government must also work to end intercommunal violence which occurred 3 weeks ago in West Darfur. Rijal says IDPs in Darfur want security and justice for crimes committed against them. Speaking in Arabic, he tells VOA, the IDPs want security and the disarmament of the Janjaweed who are committing crimes against humanity. They want the perpetrators of war crimes and crimes against humanity to be handed over to the International Criminal Court, including Bashir, Ahmed Haroun, Mohammed Hussein, and all those wanted by the court. And after that, the people that occupied their homes and land must be removed. It's a major thing because if you want to return home and there is someone occupied your land or farm, you cannot return until this person is removed. They also want individual and communal compensation for crimes committed against them. The United Nations is appealing to donors to provide funds to deliver life-saving assistance to the more than 180,000 IDPs in Darfur. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
Still on Sudan, Sudan has ratified UN conventions against torture and enforced disappearances after approval by the country's governing body, opposition parties and former rebels. Rights groups and activists who suffered under the rule of former President Omar al-Bashir have welcomed the decision. For VOA News, Naba Muhyiddin reports from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
On Tuesday, Sudan's Sovereign Council ratified UN conventions against torture and enforced disappearances after months of delay. At a press conference, Minister of Justice Nasreddin Abdulbari confirmed Sudan's ratification of the conventions and described the step as huge and important. Abdulbari says the two councils have discussed the 2006 UN Conventions for the Protection of All Persons from Enforced Disappearances and 1984 Convention Against Torture and Inhuman Punishment. The two councils have ratified to join the two conventions. This step is historical due to the massive issues Sudanese have suffered out of torture, which was common in the past regime, and the cases of enforced disappearances. Sudan's second most important political body, the Ministers' Council, approved the two conventions last November. The Sovereign Council waited, a delay that rights groups attribute to the likely involvement of the military's rapid support forces in some abuses, specifically the kidnapping and torture of 45-year-old Bahanuri in December. Imad Hamdoun was a victim of both torture and enforced disappearance during the iron-fisted rule of Omar al-Bashir. In 2019, he was arrested, tortured, and lost the sight in one eye. He says ratifying these laws is a victory for them, as rights defenders and victims of June 30 regime. He hopes that the government signs the two conventions to the UN General Secretary as soon as, so the Sudanese people are able to have these privileges they have been deprived of in the past years of the former regime. Rights groups have also welcomed the step and are calling on the government to set many procedures to validate the pacts. This is Winnie Umar, the spokesperson of Protect the Right to Life campaign, a movement of lawyers, rights activists, and the families of torture and disappearance victims. She says they welcome the step made by the transitional government. She thinks this step should be followed by a group of procedures and set ground rules for these rights, like monitoring and lifting immunity and many other procedures to guarantee the validity of the conventions on reality. On a related issue, the Sudanese Supreme Court has upheld death sentences for 29 security officers convicted of kidnapping, torturing and killing a teacher during the uprisings that toppled Bashir in 2019. Naba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, what are West African countries doing to combat Ebola cases? Stay tuned for details on that story after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your favorite meal?
I like chips and anything braai, whether chicken or beef.
My favorite meal is our fish, mainly chambo, and local vegetables like nkwani.
I love chapati. Like, I don't know why I love chapati, but I just love chapati. There's no reason for loving it. Like, chapati every day.
My favorite meal is jollof and rice with chicken. That will be best for me.
My favorite food, matoke, that is banana, and beans. Banana and beans, yes.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. The U.S. Senate has confirmed career diplomat Linda Thomas Greenfield as the United States permanent representative to the United Nations. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports Thomas Greenfield is likely to be tested by countries like China at the world body.
Despite objections from some Republican senators that delayed the vote, Ambassador Linda Thomas Greenfield received strong bipartisan support on Capitol Hill Tuesday, with more than 20 Republicans joining Democrats to confirm her as the U.S. representative to the United Nations.
On this vote, the yeas are 78, the nays are 20. The nomination is confirmed.
During her confirmation hearing last month, Thomas Greenfield sought to dispel concerns voiced by some senators that she might be soft on the communist government in China. Linda Thomas Greenfield, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations.
In particular, we know China is working across the UN system to drive an authoritarian agenda that stands in opposition to the founding values of the institution, American values. Their success depends on our continued withdrawal. That will not happen on my watch.
Echoing the sentiment, State Department spokesperson Ned Price on Tuesday said American values and U.S. allies and partnerships are a source of strength in competing against China on the world stage. State Department spokesperson Ned Price.
When we seek to take on China alone, as we've done in the past, I think that the results would be meager compared to what we can do when we are galvanizing collective action.
During Thomas Greenfield's 35-year State Department career, she worked in both Democratic and Republican administrations. As an Africa specialist, she served as U.S. Ambassador to Liberia and held posts in Kenya, Gambia, and Nigeria. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Still on U.S. affairs, in a speech to the U.N. Human Rights Council, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has reaffirmed Washington's commitment to press for universal protection and promotion of human rights. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights Situation in Eritrea, Mohamed Abdel Salam Babiker, started his mandate on November 1st. An Ethiopian military offensive began in Tigray November 4th, after months of rising tensions between Addis Ababa and forces of the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. When the conflict erupted, he says more than 96,000 Eritrean refugees were in four camps. Addressing the Human Rights Council on Wednesday, Babiker said he has received information from credible sources about the precarious situation of Eritrean refugees and asylum seekers in the province. Babiker added,
"I was concerned about the allegations of possible implication of the Eritrean troops in cases of serious human rights violations, including acts of abductions, forceful or involuntary return of Eritrean refugees and asylum seekers, and their imprisonment in different prisons inside Eritrea. Such allegations need to be investigated promptly and thoroughly by independent mechanisms."
There was no response from the Ethiopian or Eritrean governments. Babiker said he is particularly concerned about two refugee camps in Tigray that hosted more than 25,000 Eritreans. These, he said, allegedly were destroyed in attacks by Eritrean and Ethiopian troops, acts which would constitute a serious breach of international humanitarian law.
On 28 January 2021, in my letter to the government of Ethiopia, I called on the Ethiopian authorities to protect the human rights of the Eritrean refugees and asylum seekers in the Tigray region, and to ensure respect for their rights under human rights law, international humanitarian law, and international refugee law.
Babiker said he wants Eritrean authorities to give him full access to refugees and asylum seekers allegedly in Eritrean prisons. Babiker also said he has received no response to previous requests from the Eritrean authorities to visit Eritrea to assess the human rights situation on the ground. Eritrean Ambassador at Large Tesfa Mikael Geratu dismissed the Special Rapporteur's report as being full of senseless allegations and of presenting a bleak, unjustified picture of his country. He said his government has succeeded in creating meaningful, sustainable development based on social justice. He added it was time for the Council to end its harassment of Eritrea and terminate its mandate on the human rights situation in the country, which has been going on for 8 years. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
West African countries are taking steps to prevent a regional outbreak of Ebola after the deadly virus killed at least 5 people in Guinea. The last outbreak several years ago killed more than 11,000 people. For VOA News, Annie Rosenberg reports from Bamako, Mali.
As Guinea launched an Ebola vaccination drive Tuesday, after an outbreak in the West African nation's southern Zetekore region, its neighbors were also preparing. The last Ebola outbreak in 2013 also started in Guinea and killed 11,300 people over 3 years as it spread to Liberia and Sierra Leone. There were also cases in Mali, Nigeria, and Senegal, and as far away as Europe and the United States. The Ebola outbreak this month was traced to a funeral for a nurse who is suspected to have died of the virus. Out of 4 confirmed and 4 probable cases, a total of 5 people have died. Zetekore, the capital of the region, is the second biggest city in Guinea and a regional transport hub. Neighboring Sierra Leone declared a level 2 emergency response. Doctors Without Borders' Lindis Hiram in Kenema District, one of the region's hardest hit by the last outbreak, says they are now better prepared.
Both the government, the Ministry of Health, and the population themselves will be more prepared this time for Ebola just because of the fact that they lived through that really large and painful outbreak in 2014-16. So, and this we see already, that people know what it is now.
In neighboring Mali, which was largely spared from the last Ebola outbreak, authorities were focused on the country's borders. Dr. Akhridi Ag Iknine is the director of Mali's National Institute for Public Health. He says a team of health workers went to the border the day after Guinea declared the February 14th outbreak.
Le lendemain, nous sommes rendus à la frontière.
Iknan says, the next day, we went to the border at Kore Mali, between Mali and Guinea to see some of the measures being taken. We noted, he says, that the measures are in place to reinforce the border with equipment and personal protective equipment, PPE, and to reactivate the vigilance team there, who were already set in motion in 2014 during the last epidemic. During the last outbreak, non-Ebola-related healthcare was severely impacted because of the strain the deadly virus put on the region's healthcare systems. While Guinea works to prevent the outbreak from spreading, Doctors Without Borders, Hiram says, in Sierra Leone, they will remain community-focused.
We know that the lessons learned from last time are very clear, and it's to involve the community in all aspects from day one, because they are the ones affected and they are the ones we need to listen to and engage with in order to stop the transmission.
Ebola vaccines were developed after the 2013 West African outbreak and have already been used in the Democratic Republic of the Congo's 2018 outbreak. The World Health Organization delivered 11,000 doses of Ebola vaccine to Guinea on Monday evening and has teams helping with the vaccination campaign. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1-202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1-202-630-8011.
We love to hear what you think about this show. Send us your short comments to our WhatsApp number, +1-202-630-8011. We'll air your comments every Friday. That's our show for this Thursday. We'll now leave you with the song Tutu Party by Emerson.
They watch like a bottom step and die. I see short skirt, hey, a mini skirt. Oh, who's one for dance with when it's party go start? I want ballet, yeah. I want ballet.
What you want?
Makale and the party back here.
Overload,
not to your business. Party na party, you come. Let me make an overload if we ask you gonna do. Oh, 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 yeah, yeah.
Somebody, every man deserves a lady. Come to party, oh no. Come jump, shake your body. Come show me, say you savvy. If you really ready, oh no. Before you even start the party, check for G-string or bikini. Now dance, man, they ready, oh no. Come see you too, so jam and so we at the party. But see when it think and it get already. My boss, Lokoti, Baba, do we wait till you say? Tell me if you really done ready. Yeah, 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 yeah.
They swing and they bounce, yeah.
We've been listening to Emerson with the song Tutu Party. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for taking time to listen to this program. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Some girls that to tune up all by nine. Free tongue girls that to the fast forward everywhere, yeah. All night long, yeah. Show me.